So I wasn't going to ask you whether you were in a group yet, because last time I asked, everybody looked like they were in a group. But I did go to the orphan list this morning, and there are six people on there still. Either you've been adopted and you haven't let me know. So if you've been adopted as an orphan, go take your name off. I just want to make sure that there's nobody hanging out on that list hoping to be adopted for the rest of the semester. So I'll assume that everybody's in the group. So let me ask it again. Is there anybody in this class who's not in a group yet? Okay. So I'm going to ask you the second question. What? Somebody put up their hand? No? I'm going to ask the second question. No, it's coming, right? Have you picked... Who's not picked a company yet? Let's get this number down as we go through. Everybody's picked a company? I don't believe it. Right? Really? Okay. So I can call on you and say, what company are you doing? And you should be able to fill in the details, right? Okay, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to start off with a very quick review of what we did last session. Not because it's difficult, but because it's so critical in understanding where we're going to go next. Okay? Last session, we talked about deriving risk and return models in finance, right? And we went through it sequentially. First step, we defined risk as variance of actual returns around around an expected return. And don't make it more complicated than it has to be. I'll give you a very simple illustration of how to think about expected returns and actual returns. Let's assume you have a one-year time horizon. And you buy a one-year T-bill. You know how a T-bill works, right? It's discounted. And let's for the moment assume that there's no default risk in the U.S. Treasury. This is actually a great launching pad for what we're going to talk about today. You have a one-year time horizon. You bought a one-year T-bill. Right now, the one-year T-bill rate is about 0.2%. A year from now, when I come and knock on your door and ask you, what did you make on this investment? What's your answer going to be? So 1 year T-bill, you had a 1 year time horizon, there's no default risk. At the end of the year, you're going to make 0.2%. That is a riskless investment. Let's move one step up the ladder. You have a 1 year time horizon, you buy a 10-year T-bond. Still default free. At the end of the year, I come and knock on your door and say, what did you make on that T-bond? What portion of your return is guaranteed when you buy a T-bond? You get the coupon, you're going to get it. What's not guaranteed? What could change? The price at which you sell a year from now could be different than the price today because interest rates can change. A 10-year T-bond is not risk-free if you have a one-year time horizon. Remember that. Let's move one step further up the ladder. Let's say you buy Coca-Cola stock. You're doing it with, you know, with reasonable expectations. An 8% return. Or let's make it even simpler, Con Ed. You know what Con Ed does, right? It supplies power to New York City. Sometimes it forgets parts of Brooklyn, but that's, you know, just a Brooklyn. It's a regulated utility, but it's a stock. You expect to make a 7% return, so you're not being unreasonable. But a year from now when I come and knock on your door, if you're lucky, you might have made 14 or 15%. If you're not, you might have made only 1 or 2%, but you almost never are going to make exact. That's a riskier investment than a T-bond, which is riskier than a T-bill. Let's move one step finally up the ladder. Talked about LinkedIn last Friday, what a bad day it was. You think this is the time for you to buy LinkedIn stock. So you go and buy the shares now. And he said, it's a risky company. I expect to make a 15% return. So you're demanding a high return. A year from now, when I come and knock on your door, what might have happened? You could have gotten lucky and the stock could have doubled. It's done it before. Or you might have screwed up and the stock could be down 80%. With all four examples, notice where the risk lay. It's always in the future, right? It's over the next year. And the reason I'm saying that is in a finance class, when I ask you to measure risk, what are you trained to do? I ask you, how risky is LinkedIn or how risky is Con Ed? What are you trained to do? Go to a Bloomberg terminal, go to something, look up the risk in the stock, but all that risk is measured looking backwards. It's one of the central conundrums which we have to confront when we talk about risk, is risk is always in the future. There is no risk in the past. It's already happened. But all our data is in the past, and we've got to wrestle with how do we take past data and extrapolate into the future, because all the risk is in the future. So first step in every risk and return model is we define risk as variance of actual returns around an expected return. That's pretty intuitive. You're saying more volatile stocks are riskier. So LinkedIn is more risky than Coca-Cola, is more risky than a T-bond, is more risky than a T-bill with a one-year time horizon. What's the second step? This is, I think, the more controversial part of finance. What do we assume about that risk? What portion of that risk are you going to get rewarded for? The risk that you cannot diversify away. And to get to that point, I had to assume what? That the marginal investor in your company was a diversified investor. I did a little song and dance. Your marginal investor is an institutional investor, probably diversified. But the song and dance, it could be true, might not be. But if you make that assumption, only that portion of the risk that you cannot diversify away is what you're going to get rewarded for. And then we talked about different risk and return models and how they measure that risk. In the CAPM, because you have no transactions costs and no private information, we measure that risk with one number, the beta. That's it. That's all you need. But then we talked about two alternatives, the arbitrage pricing model where we allowed for multiple sources of market risk and betas against each one. And a multi-factor model where you put names on the factors, like interest rates, term structure, and came up with betas against each one. That's where we stopped. But there's one final variant of risk and return models in finance that started showing up about 25 years ago. I mentioned that there was a study that found that only 8% of the variation in returns across stocks is explained by differences in betas. That came from two professors at the University of Chicago called Gene Farmer and Ken French. And what they did as a follow-up was they said, you know what? Why are we even trying to build a risk and return model? All we need is hurdle rates, right? So let's let the market tell us what's safe and what's risky. You say, how will the market tell you? They went back and got 30 years of returns on stocks, and they looked to see what kinds of companies earned high returns and what kinds of companies earned low returns. And they found that small market cap companies earned much higher returns than large market cap companies. And they made a leap of faith. They said, if small market cap companies earn higher returns than large market cap companies over very long periods, it must mean they're riskier. Do you see why that's a leap of faith? You're assuming that the market would not give you higher returns unless you're riskier. They found that low price-to-book value companies where the market value is much lower than the accounting book value, had much higher returns than high price-to-book ratio companies. And they made the leap of faith again. They said, therefore, price-to-book must be a measure of risk, and low price-to-book must mean you're a risky company. And at the end of their research, they actually created a regression equation where basically they looked across companies, and if you gave me your price-to-book ratio and your market cap, they would plug it into the equation and say, this is what your hurdle rate should be. So if you're a small company with a high price-to-book ratio, small company with a low price-to-book ratio, and I plug the numbers in, you're going to come up with a hurdle rate of 18%. You can complain to me about how safe your business is, but I'm going to say, too bad. Given what you look like as a company, your hurdle rate is going to be high or low. Those models are called proxy models for risk. Why? Because you've given up on measuring risk. You're letting something else stand in, the market cap, the price-to-book ratio. And since 91, there have been other proxies that people have found because we have more data now. We can keep looking through the data for something else. And so the list of proxies gets longer and longer and longer every year. But just like the multi-factor models, proxy models are always going to explain more than the CAPM does. Why? Because I'm looking for the variables that are the highest R squared. It's a statistical exercise, right? I had market cap, it didn't work. Price to book, I put something else. Until I get to a high R squared, I'm not going to stop. So if your job is explaining past returns, a proxy model is going to do much better than the CAPM is. In fact, a lot of portfolio managers get evaluated using proxy models. So if you're a mutual fund manager, what people look at is what kind of companies you invest in. They plug it into the proxy model and say, based on what you invest in, you outperform the market, you underperformed. So this is the state of play on the ground. You've got the CAPM, the arbitrage pricing model, the multi-factor model, the proxy models. And as I mentioned last session, the CAPM kind of hangs in there. In fact, I think I've read, in The Economist alone, I've read at least a dozen articles that claim that the CAPM is dead. Beta's dead. Beta's died more often than Freddy Krueger has. Right? But every Halloween, he's back. So beta, in a sense, people bury beta. This is the end. This new model is going, and it seems to come back. And I explained why. It takes a model to beat a model. These other models look much better looking backwards, but when you try to use them to forecast future returns and get hurdle rates for companies, it looks like the CAPM does at least as well as any of those other models. And think about it. If you can estimate one beta and come up with an expected return that's crappy, why would you go through an exercise of estimating five betas and coming up with an equally crappy return? Until there's a payoff to doing all this additional work, why do it? And that's why when you go into banks, consulting firms, and corporations, you still see the CAPM as the default model for estimating hurdle rates. So when you get a chance with your company, once you pick your company, so all the qualifiers apply, okay, take a look at what the stock holding in your company looks like. What percentage is held by institutions? What percentage is by individuals? It's not difficult to do. You can find it on Yahoo Finance. You can find it on Bloomberg. You can find it in a dozen different places. Look at the composition. Look at the top 17 stockholders, and then make your best judgment. Notice the word I use, best judgment. You will still have to make a judgment. So please don't email me saying, is my judgment right? The essence of judgment is it's a judgment. So make it. That's part of this class, is you have to feel empowered to say, hey, I know enough that I can make a judgment, and then use that to decide whether you're on solid ground, assuming the marginal investors diversify. So if you picked a really small company in an emerging market, you might run into a bit of a brick wall when you start doing this, because you might find that very few institutions hold your stock, and the people owning your stock are not that diversified. Don't worry, we'll talk about what to do with those companies. But that's why we're looking at the composition of who the owners of your company are. Any questions about risk and return models? Okay. So here's what we're going to do. We're now going to start to try to come up with the numbers to use the CAPM. If you don't like the CAPM, any of these numbers you have to get for the other models as well. So we're going to start with very simple questions about how do we come up with the inputs we need to get an expected return. Remember, that's the end game. We want a hurdle rate. So let me set up the equation. The expected return in the CAPM is a risk-free rate plus a beta times what I'm going to call an equity risk premium. The equity risk premium is the number in the brackets. It's the difference between what you expect to make on stocks collectively and the risk-free rate. So you basically need three numbers to get an expected return for any company. You need a risk-free rate, you need a beta, you need an equity risk premium. Before you even embark on estimating these numbers, which of these three numbers should be the easiest one to get? Yeah. The risk-free rate. I remember 2 years of my MBA program. You know how much time we spent on the risk-free rate? This is 1979. I think 2 minutes. I was told the risk-free rate is the U.S. Treasury rate, and we moved on. Shows you how dollar-centric MBA education was then, and how trusting we were about the U.S. Treasury never defaulting. Those are days of innocence. We were done, risk-free rate. I'm afraid it's not that simple anymore. So what I'm going to do is lay out what we need for something to be risk-free. In a sense, think of that one-year time horizon, one-year T-bill example, and you'll see exactly what we need for something to be risk-free. For an investment to be risk-free, the actual return always has to be equal to the expected return. So you expect 0.2%, the actual return always has to be 0.2. That is the essence of something being risk-free. So if you think about it, there are two requirements or two criteria for something to be risk-free. The first is the entity issuing the security can have no default risk, not even a tiny bit. See, what if it's just a little bit of default risk? That's like being a little bit pregnant. It doesn't quite work. You either are or not. It's a 0-1 game. So you're either default-free or you're not. So don't dance around and say, what if France, look, it's close to default. No, if you have default risk, the game is over. So it has to be default-free. Already you can see why getting a risk-free rate is going to get more difficult, at least in some currencies. Second, there can be no reinvestment risk. So what are you talking about? Let's say you want a 5-year risk-free rate. Is a 1-year T-bill a good measure of a 5-year risk-free rate? Let's say you invest in a 1-year T-bill. You're going to make 0.2% over the next year, right? What do you not know? What you'll make next year, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. So for a 5-year risk-free rate, what do I need? A 5-year T-bond should work, right? With one small caveat. Every 6 months on a T-bond, you get a coupon. That coupon is to get reinvested, which is a pain in the neck. You don't know what you'll reinvest at. So do you think I can strip the coupons? Think of it like a coupon book. Can I take all the coupons out and leave you with just the face value? That's called stripping a treasury bond. You end up with what's called a zero coupon bond. And when you're done, you end up with a five-year zero coupon bond because all you have is one cash flow at the end of 5 years. Already, you can see this is going to get messy because for a five-year cash flow, then I need a five-year zero coupon default-free bond. For a four-year cash flow, I need a four-year default-free zero coupon bond. For a three-year cash flow, so if you have 10 years of cash flows, each one, if you're a purist, should have its own risk-free rate. Thank God I'm not a purist, because can you imagine how messy your Excel spreadsheet will start to get? You won't have one discount rate. Your risk-free rate will vary across time. Your discount rates will vary across time. You can't use that present value function in Excel anymore. It's not going to work. So if I can avoid it, I'd like to avoid it. So here's what I'm going to suggest. Rather than being a purist and matching up each cash flow to a risk-free rate that's right for the cash flow, I'm going to do what banks used to do until the 1980s. The way banks used to manage interest rate risk was by doing what was called duration matching. You're saying, what the heck is that? Let's say you have 50 loans. Those are the assets of the banks, the loans they made. And some are two-year loans, some are five-year loans, some are 10-year loans, some are 30-year loans. In theory, the bank was supposed to match up each loan with a liability of exactly the same duration. So the two-year loan with the... And that's a pain if you have 100 loans. So what they would do is take the average of the maturities or durations of the 100 loans they granted and try to set their liability to have the same average duration. It wasn't perfect, but they said it's close enough. Let's try this in the context of what we do in corporate finance. Let's suppose I give you a project with 10 years of cash flows, year one, year two, year three. You can compute a duration for your cash flows by just taking a weighted average of when the cash flows come in. So if your big cash flows come towards the end, the weighted average might be 7.5 years. So the big cash flows coming towards the beginning, it might be 2.5 years. Then find a risk-free rate with roughly the same duration. In fact, I'll make it even simpler. In corporate finance, if you can find me a 10-year default-free rate, I'm pretty much home. That's all I need as a risk-free rate. So what we're going to do is start easy. We're going to start in U.S. dollars. And I'm going to ask you to give me a 10-year default-free rate in U.S. dollars. And then we're going to go to more and more difficult cash flows to work with. So with U.S. dollars, what is the risk-free rate today? So if I ask you to go look up the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars, what are you going to use? Given my criteria of 10-year default-free, what are you going to use as your risk-free rate today? You open up the Wall Street Journal. You don't even have to open it up. Right in the front page. What do you get? You can find the U.S. 10-year Treasury bond rate, right? Right now, it's about 1.91%. You think that's so low? That's not for you and I to decide. That's what it is today, 1.91%. And right after you decide to use it as a risk-free rate, get down on your knees and hope and pray that the U.S. Treasury has no default risk. That's no longer a given. I don't know whether you remember, but 3 years ago, during the summer of 2012, S&P downgraded the U.S. government. The U.S. government had always had a AAA rating, and S&P actually down. It wasn't a bad downgrade, but it was no longer AAA. Huge amount of blowback at S&P. But the reality is the genie's out of the bottle. You can no longer take for granted. So if you assume the U.S. Treasury is default-free, the risk-free rate you would use today would be the U.S. 10-year T-bond rate of 1.91%. A lot of the numbers I've crunched in this lecture note packet come from November of 2013. In November of 2013, the 10-year bond rate was 2.75%. So that's what you're going to see as my risk-free rate, not for the U.S., but in U.S. dollars. And I'm going to draw a distinction between a country and a currency. And you're going to see why when I start talking about the euro. So U.S. dollar, the risk-free rate I'm going to use is a 10-year T-bond rate. Question?
In terms of the formula, do you actually need an absolute risk-free rate for just a rate that everybody knew what risk-free rate? If all investors knew it as risk-free, or is the least risky option on the planet, then...
The question is, if this is viewed as the least risky option, is it risk-free? Not good enough for me. So if, let's say that we get to, in fact, I wrote a paper, this is after 2008, I call these my nightmare papers, which is I took given things in finance, said, what if that's no longer true? Like, what if nothing is liquid anymore? What if we woke up tomorrow and everything was frozen? And one of my nightmare papers was, what if nothing is risk-free? We're not that far away from that reality, right? We can no longer take for granted. But let's say we wake up to that. We will still have to work to get to risk-free. I'll give you a process of getting there. But you still can't say, this is the lowest number I can get. Because it is not. So risk-free rate, November 2013, in U.S. dollars, was 2.75%. That'll take care of Disney, right? Because I'm doing Disney in U.S. dollars. But Deutsche, I'm doing in euros. I need a risk-free rate in euros. So what did I do for the U.S. dollar? I went and found a government bond denominated in U.S. dollars, the U.S. government, and I used the rate on that as my risk-free rate, right? So why did you do that for the euro? Well, I ran into a bit of a problem. In November of 2013, I went looking for a government bond denominated in euros, and I found 11 governments, all issuing 10-year bonds, all denominated in euros. Let me make this a really messy choice for you. Let's assume you're analyzing a Spanish company. Let's make it a Greek company. Let's make it even better. A Greek company in euros. What do you need? Not a Greek risk-free rate. Remember I said countries don't have risk-free rate, currencies do. You need a euro risk-free rate. So which of these rates should I use as my risk-free rate for a Greek company? But it's a Greek company. Don't you want to punish it for being Greek? So I should use the German rate, but the German rate is only 1.75%. You can see why people resist this, right? Because what are they saying? It's a Greek company. It's a Greek company. It's a Greek company. The rate's supposed to be high. What they forget is the risk-free rate is the start of the game. I'll give you plenty of chances to punish this company for being Greek. But the risk-free rate is not it. The risk-free rate I would use would be the German euro bond rate. And even that's a little messy because the minute you have a monetary union, you've given up control. What makes a U.S. Treasury default-free? Is it because the U.S. government is this incredibly efficient, well-run? No. It's because they have the damn printing presses out there, and if they need the money, they print the money. Legally, none of the rest of us, if we had printing presses in our basements, we'd never run out of money. Mortgage payment due. God, look, we'll run it downstairs a little faster with lots of payment. Credit card payment due. Not a problem. So what makes the U.S. default free is we assume that if they have a little deficit, they can go run the machines a little faster. Germany can no longer do that because once you became part of the Eurozone, you essentially turned over monetary policy to the European Central Bank. But we're assuming that Germany is the closest thing we're going to get to default-free. And if you don't believe it's default-free, you could even use a bond issued by the European Central Bank. In fact, that rate is almost equal to the German bond rate, telling me that the market thinks Germany is close to risk-free. Yes? Well, when you say benchmark, what do you mean by benchmark? That doesn't make it a risk-free rate. So the fact that they have to borrow money at a really low rate has a risk-free rate in there. But why is it 8.3%? When you look at the difference between the 8.3 and the 1.75, why is the market charging so much more for buying a Greek government bond? Greek default risk. So what you're saying is when a company in Greece borrows, it has two default risks it carries on its shoulders. One is the default risk for Greece, and the other is the default risk for the company. We'll take care of that. When we get to the cost of debt, I'll let you add back. So don't mistake what you have to do to get to a cost of debt for a company and a cost of equity for a company for the risk-free rate. Greek companies borrow at a high rate, not because the euro risk-free rate is high, but because Greek default risk is high. And we need to separate the two, because the two come from very different places and to be treated very differently in valuation. So when you do a euro valuation, a euro cash flows, your risk-free rate has to be a German euro bond rate. Right now, you know what that rate looks like? I told you what the US dollar rate looks like, 1.91%. German 10-year euro bond rate right now is 0.7%. So, and we'll talk about why risk-free rates vary across currencies, but the euro bond rate is much lower now than the USD bond rate. Now let's make life really interesting. I've Tata Motors in my stable, right? I've got to come up with an Indian rupee risk-free rate. I've Vale that I'm looking at. I need a nominal RIA risk-free rate. So all I need to do is find a default-free entity in Brazil. Good luck with that, right? So now we're starting. So if you had things like US dollars or euros or Swiss francs, you can essentially take the government bond rate and say, that's my risk-free rate. So these are all governments which are AAA rated governments. And I'm going to say, you know what, there's no default risk in these governments. Those are my risk-free rates. And you know, those are all the AAA rated governments at the time that I did this. But the real tricky part is, now what do I do if I have a government that is not AAA rated, that has default risk embedded in it? Start thinking through the algebra. So when I give you a Brazilian government bond rate in reais, it's not risk-free. Why? Because there's default risk in it, right? So to make it default-free, what do you need to do? Take out the default risk. It's not magic. If I can somehow tell you how much of that rate is due to default risk, you can take it out. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take, in this case, November of 2013, the Indian government bond. This is a rupee-denominated bond. The rate was 8.82%. So that's the Indian government bond rate. But it's not risk-free. Why? Because the Indian government, at least in November of 2013, was not default-free. So if I can somehow tell you how much of that 8.82% is due to default risk, you can take it out of the 8.82 and you'll be home free, right? So here's what I did. Rather than go ask some expert about, is there default risk in India, which is a useless exercise, I went to the Moody's website. If you ever visited Moody's, S&P has a similar section. They have a thing called sovereign ratings. Click on it. I'll send you the link after class today. Click on it, and you'll get a list of 151 countries that Moody's rates as countries. And it actually gives you two ratings for every country, a foreign currency rating and a local currency rating. What's the difference? So when I look at Indonesia, I see a foreign currency rating, a local currency rating. Why does Moody's give me two different ratings for Indonesia? What does a foreign currency rating measure when I see it? It measures how much default risk Moody sees in Indonesia when they borrow in US dollars, euros, yen, etc., some foreign currency. That's a foreign currency. I wasn't interested in the foreign currency rating. I went to the local currency rating, and I hoped and prayed I'd see a AAA rating for India here. Why? Because if there were a AAA rating for India under the local currency, I could take the 8.82%, use that as my risk-free rate, and if something went wrong, blame Moody's. Unfortunately, the rating that India had in November of 2013 was a Baa3. Not a horrible rating, but not AAA. I have a lookup table where if you tell me what the rating of your country is, I'll tell you what the typical spread that goes with that rating is. The spread being what you charge given that rating. And in November of 2013, for a Baa3 rated country, that spread was 2.25%. So let's do the algebra. The Indian government bond rate in rupees is 8.82%. I'm worried because there's some default risk in there. And if you trust my lookup table, 2.25% of that number comes from default risk. I'm going to take it out of the 8.82%. And again, don't worry. If you want to punish a company for being an Indian company, I'll give you plenty of chances again down the road. This is not the place I want to do it. My risk-free rate in Indian rupees is 6.57%. Then I went to China because I have Baidu in my, now I want to look at. I want a Chinese renminbi risk-free rate. Yeah?
I was wondering how you calculated the default spread.
Well, the lookup, you want to know how I came up with the spreads? I'm going to give you three ways of coming up with default spreads and how you can use them to create this lookup table. So hang on just a moment because we'll go through the default spread on the next page. Okay? Let's try a Chinese renminbi risk-free rate. In November of 2013, the Chinese renminbi government bond rate was 4.3%. Again, I worry, is there a default risk in there? I went to Moody's. Moody's rating for China was much better than India's rating, Baa3. The default spread for that rating was only 0.8%. You subtract that from the 4.3, I've got my risk-free rate in Chinese renminbi. And my stomach dropped because I had to go look at Vale. And then I got lucky because I remembered it was a commodity company. You're saying, so what? It's a Brazilian company, but it's a commodity company. And across the world, if you look at the financial statements for commodity companies, take BP, British Oil Company. Take a look at its financials. You know what currency it's reported in? Around the world, commodity companies report their financials in US dollars. But you think, but it's a Brazilian company. I can analyze any company in any currency I pick. And in this case, why would I want to go looking for trouble when I have all the numbers in dollars? Might as well do the analysis in dollars. And if I'm going to do it in dollars, what should the risk-free rate be? November of 2013 was 2.75%. Again, don't worry about the fact that it's a Brazilian company. When you come to risk-free rates, it's all about what currency you've chosen. In this case, we have risk-free rates essentially in any currency we want, if we can start with the government bond rate and clean it up. Now, in Latin America, for a long time, people worried about doing things in the local currencies, especially when inflation was 20, 30, 50%. And for much of the 80s and the 90s, that was the case across Latin America. So across Latin America, people used to do their analysis in what were called real terms. You're saying, what does that mean? When they projected cash flows, projected revenues, they projected constant prices, today's prices, and all that caused your revenues to grow then was you had to sell more units. Those are called real cash flows. If you do everything in real terms, your risk-free rate has to be a real risk-free rate. I'm going to make this point over and over again in this class about currency consistency. When you sit down to do an analysis and you pick a currency to do your cash flows in, pick a currency, because Vale, I picked the US dollar. I could have done it in nominal reais. Your risk-free rate has to be in the same currency. And if you do everything in real terms, your risk-free rate has to be a real risk-free rate. Until 20 years ago, I'd throw my hands around and say, I don't know what where to get a real risk-free rate. But I don't know whether you're familiar with a treasury security called the TIPS. You heard of this? It's an inflation-protected treasury bond. It works actually in a very strange way. You go in, is right now the rate is about 0.5%. You say, why do I want to get a 0.5% return? It's really not 0.5. It's 0.5 plus whatever the inflation rate that is that year. So if you get a TIPS rate, you're guaranteed the 0.5%. If inflation next year is 1%, your coupon will be 1 plus 0.5, 1.5. Inflation next year is 10%, it'll be 10.5. If inflation next year is minus 0.5%, you'll have no coupon at all. It's basically a protected rate where you're going to be guaranteed a real rate of return. That's what you could use as a real risk-free rate. So the process for getting to a risk-free rate is very simple. You find a government bond denominated in that currency. Check to see if that government is AAA rated. If it's AAA rated, you're pretty much done. You can use that as your risk-free rate. If it's not AAA rated, you have to clean up for it by taking out the default risk from the government bond rate. You have a question? No.
So earlier you were saying there was actually a fear that the U.S. treasury bonds aren't risk-free. Is that fear's bond?
Basically, Moody's is stuck with AAA, and S&P is, you know, they left it at AA+, but they treated it as a AAA. So there was that period, especially before the fiscal cliff, which was this fight between Congress and the president about the budget that caused this. It seems to have dissipated for the moment. But you know what? If 3 years from now, the U.S. were lowered from AAA to AA, what would I need to do to get a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars? I'd have to start with the U.S. T-bond rate, and then I'd have to do what I did for China and India, take out the default spread.
Wouldn't that still only your
returns? Well, I think that the question is, I mean, that's your optimistic view, right?
What's happened before?
Well, it's never happened before, but it's happened in other countries before, right? The fact that it hasn't happened in the U.S. doesn't mean it cannot happen. There's a difference between it hasn't happened in the past and saying it'll never happen in the future. Until 2012, the conventional wisdom is it'll never happen in the future. In 2012, people started at least asking the question, maybe it could happen in the future. Most people now have come to the conclusion it's probably not going to happen in the future, but it's not the certainty that you had pre-2012. Yeah. Yes?
Can we take
out? No, this has nothing to do with the company. Again, this has nothing to do with the company. Right? This is about a risk-free rate in a currency. So I'm not sure where you can get a risk-free rate, how a risk-free rate from a company can help you on a country. So there's nothing to do. It's nothing to do with the company. So this is about getting a risk-free rate in a currency. So you've got to kind of steer away from the company when you make this assessment. Okay? So now let me talk a little bit about the question you asked. Yeah. The question was, when would I ever use a real risk-free rate? I don't even remember the last time I did things in real terms, because you're right. Not only do you have to do everything in real terms, but your taxes are computed in nominal terms. So if I can avoid it, I'm going to. But you can see why people were drawn to it. If you have 80% inflation, 120% inflation, people stop even thinking about currencies. They prefer to go back to real terms. So then let me talk about how I got the 2.25% for India and the 0.8%. for China. And I'll send you a list with the updated numbers right now for what to, for you to be able to do it. In fact, this week's In Practice webcast actually takes you through the process of actually coming up with these spreads and coming up with the risk-free rates. There are three ways you can come up with a default spread for a country. The first is if you can find dollar-denominated bonds issued by that country, and you can compare that to the T-bond rate, you got a measure of default risk for that country. I'll give you an example. November of 2013, the 10-year Brazilian dollar-denominated, so this is not a real-denominated, it's a dollar-denominated bond, had an interest rate of 4.25%. It's a dollar bond. The T-bond that day was 2.75%. The difference between the two is a default spread for Brazil, 1.5%. So that's the first way. That works in a lot of Latin American countries. It doesn't work in Asia because most Asian countries do not have dollar or euro-denominated bonds. It works in Eastern Europe. Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia have euro-denominated bonds. Those you compare to what to get risk-free rate? The German euro bond rate, because in a sense you have to stay currency consistent. So that's the first try. You can do that. Until about 10 or 12 years ago, that's the only way I could get default spreads for sovereigns. About 10 or 12 years ago, a new market was created called the CDS market, the credit default swap market. I don't know whether you've heard of it, but it's actually got a fair amount of press because of, you know, how big it's become and how people are worried about what it might do. It's basically an insurance market. Let me explain. Let's assume you go out and buy a Brazilian bond today. It's a US dollar-denominated Brazilian bond, and the coupon rate is 7.5%. You're feeling pretty good, right? You're going to make a 7.5% return. You say, oh my God, but it's a Brazilian bond. I could default. Or they could default, not you could default. And you want to buy insurance. The CDS market is where you go to buy insurance. Right now, the Brazilian CDS is 5.5%. So how does this work? You buy a Brazilian bond. You get a 7.5% return. You bought insurance, so you're going to take 5.5% out of it. You think that's going to give me pretty much what I could have made investing in T-bonds? Of course. What else did you expect? This isn't a money machine. Otherwise, we'd all be rich. So a CDS spread is like an updated default spread. Today, I can give you default spreads for about 61 countries based on the CDS market. So I can get about 25 countries. I can get dollar-denominated, euro-denominated bonds. I can get CDS for about 60. Yeah. It is? Well, you're saying, why do different markets? Because one is set by Moody's, and it's based on a ratings agency assessment of default. You're saying, why is the bond market and this market? Because they're two different markets with two different depths, two different liquidities. The CDS market, in fact, is a more liquid market. It reacts to more recent events. The two numbers are usually not that different. Right now, for instance, the government bond market, the Brazilian spread is 5.3%. The CDS market is 5.5%. But the ratings agencies haven't even woken up yet. They haven't even changed the rating. So in a sense, they're both market numbers, but the CDS is a more liquid market. It's a deeper market. There's much more trading going on. So I'll give you an example. When Russia invaded Ukraine, the CDS market reacted right away. When Russia invaded Ukraine, the ratings agencies took about 6 months to get around to changing because they're slow. Right? So, yeah. Well, I think countries think the market is the reason there. So Greece kept blaming the CDS market for its troubles. So without the CDS market, we'd never be in default risk. This is actually part of the problem. People think markets deliver these bad messages sometimes. Look at the Chinese government. They're convinced that this is a gigantic conspiracy by markets to bring them down. It's not. Markets do what they do. So CDS markets often are chosen as these instruments. So this is why we're in trouble, is because the CDS market has pushed up spreads for us. It's a market. People get scared about what you're going to do. The spreads are going to widen. But because it's there and people can see it, there are some countries, for instance, which have refused to have sovereign CDS traded on them. You need the country's, you know, acquiescence to get it traded. Some countries have said, no, you can't trade CDS because we don't want people to see the day-to-day variation in what people think about us as a country. Okay. So those are the first two. So what did I say? 25 countries with ratings, 61 with CDS spreads. I want to ask you how many countries there are in the world. But believe me, there are more than 61 countries. There are like 175 countries. Which means if I came to you with one of those countries which does not have a government bond in dollars or a CDS, you're saying, what do I do now? And that's where my lookup table comes in. And here's how I constructed the lookup table. I have 61 countries for which I have CDS spreads, right? I have the ratings for the 61 countries. In Excel, you can sort based on ratings. You can create a pivot. Have you done this? You do a pivot table where it essentially classifies companies based, no, classifies countries based on ratings. I come up with the average spread by rating. I make it a lookup table. Why do I need it? Because if you came to me with a country which does not have a CDS and does not have a dollar-denominated bond, I can't throw up my hand and say, nothing I can do. I have to do the best I can. So if you get a chance, watch the Friday In Practice webcast, because I'll take you, you know, sequentially through this process. And once you've gone through it, I'll give you the updated numbers as of today, and you can do your own risk-free rates in as many currencies as you can, as you want to. So this is what the numbers look like in November of 2013. So these are risk-free rates. So the gray part is the risk-free rate. The purple part is the default spread that I've taken out to get to the risk-free rate. Defaults in risk-free rates in currencies ranging from the Taiwanese dollar, which had the lowest risk-free rate in November of 2013, to the Brazilian real, which had the highest. That is November of 2013. I updated at the start of this year, so you can see how much numbers change. This is what the risk-free rates look like in January 2016. And there are a couple of things here that you might want to focus on. First is, there are a couple of currencies with negative risk-free rates, right? That's almost mind-boggling. Because what's the definition of a risk-free rate? It's what you charge when you lend people money on a guaranteed basis. And what does a negative risk-free rate tell you? That when you lend people, rather than them paying you, you have to pay them. Get your mind wrapped around the concept. Because in parts of Europe, this is already the case. Banks are charging people for you to have a checking account. You try to save money, that will cost you 2% a year. You say, what? It's an aberration. It cannot last for the long term because after a while, ask yourself, why would I lend money? You say, why didn't I just take it as cash and put it under my bed? Well, that might work if you have $100 in cash, but if you have $100 million in cash, I'm going to first find out where you live. Then I'm going to find out how high your bed is. Then I'm going to figure out a way to make sure you never get out of bed. And then I'm going to clean out all the cash. So there are security there are reasons why we can't go back to a cash economy. And maybe we've screwed ourselves by going to credit cards and everything becoming card-based because can you imagine trying? There are some places you can't even survive without credit cards. And in a sense, if you're in a negative risk-free rate environment, you might be paying people to lend money to them. There are actually homeowners who are borrowing money in Denmark where the bank pays them every month. Think about that. You borrow money to buy a house, and the bank every month sends you a check saying, good job. As I said, mind-boggling. So at one end, you've got these really, really low, so even if it's not negative, really low risk-free rates in some currencies. At the other extreme, if you look at Russian rubles and Brazilian reais and Nigerian naira and South African rand, the risk-free rate is really high. So I'm going to ask you a question. If you can answer this question, and we kind of talked about this in the very first class, you can think about why it doesn't matter what currency you use in doing your analysis. Why are risk-free rates different in different currencies? I asked you the same question, I think, early on in this class. Why do risk-free rates vary across currencies? It's inflation. High inflation currencies have high risk-free rates. Low inflation currencies have low risk-free rates. So let's work this through. If you pick a high risk-free rate currency, what's going to happen to all your hurdle rates? So if I do everything in reais, my hurdle rates are going to be 23, 25, 27%, right? Because I'm starting with a 10% base. But if I do all my cash flows also in reais, that high inflation that hurt me in the discount rate is now going to help me when I do my cash flows, because even if I don't sell very many more units, I'm still going to get 12% growth every year because of high inflation. The key with currencies, therefore, is consistency. You pick a high inflation currency to do your hurdle rates, then you know what else you have to do. When you do your cash flows, your earnings, your growth rates, you have to stick with that same high inflation currency. So think about that when you think about risk-free rates. Yes?
So what's the highest net risk-free rate, considering that you subtracted the default risk and subtracted the inflation?
No, I'm not subtracting out the inflation. If I subtract out the inflation, where am I going to end up? You're going to end up with the real, and you know what? Around the world, real risk-free rates are going to converge because that's what causes capital to move around. So don't subtract out the inflation because we work with nominal numbers. We leave the inflation in. So if you do things in U.S. dollars, stick with the U.S. risk-free rate, which has the U.S. inflation rate embedded in it. If you decide to do everything in Russian rubles, stick with a high discount rate, but make sure that same high inflation helps you on the cash flows. So don't net out the inflation, net out just the default spread to get to a nominal risk-free rate in different currencies.
But if I were an investor, I would want to remove inflation, right? So I know how much I'm really earning on my money.
Well, you're really earning your nominal amount, right, in a sense. You know, so you, nobody thinks in real terms. I've never talked to anybody who said, no, over the last 23 years, my returns on my portfolio are 7% in real terms. We tend to think in nominal terms because we make payments in nominal terms, right? So you're right, we ultimately want to think about real returns, but our taxes are... Well, as long as you have inflation 100, 200%, in nominal terms, make sure you earn 100 to 200% at the minimum, right? So that's the only lesson I take out of this. So if you have really high inflation in a currency, you got to cover it, right? So any questions about risk-free rates? I know it's a messy process. I wish I could give you the same lesson I got 2 minutes ago. It's a U.S. Treasury, it's a risk-free rate, you know. But already you can see that if I asked you what the risk-free rate is, before you answer the question, what do you need to ask me? In what currency? Never, ever answer a question about risk-free rates. And you'll have bankers who are incredibly sloppy about this. My suggestion is let them go. But the reality is when somebody asks you what the risk-free rate is, you need a currency before you can answer it because it depends on what currency you're talking about. And there's no global risk-free rate. I've heard people talk, say absurd things like there's a global... There is no global risk. It's currency-based. There's a dollar risk-free rate. There's a euro risk-free rate. There's a real risk-free rate. But there's no global risk-free rate because there's no global currency. Currencies basically determine risk-free rates. So second step in the process. Yeah. Well, you got to pick a currency to do your analysis in. Or take each currency. So, for instance, the question was, what if you're Nestle or Coca-Cola? You have 25 different revenue streams in different currencies. You have two choices. You can convert them all into one currency, in U.S. dollars, and do everything in U.S. dollar terms. Or you can leave the 25 currency streams separate. And then what do you have to do? Have a different risk-free rate for each one. So pick your poison. I mean, in a sense, there's no easy way around it. It's the flip side of globalization. Now let's move to the second number, the equity risk premium. I'll set the table for you, and then we'll talk about how to estimate it. The equity risk premium is what I'd like to make over and above the risk-free rate for investing in equities as a class. You say, what the hell are you talking about? What is the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars right now? Is that about 1.9%, something like that? The question I'm asking is, if you can make 1.9% guaranteed, how much more than 1.9% would you need to make to put your money into stocks? And already I want you to start thinking about it because it is specific to you. So you say, I need to make at least 3% more, at least 5% more. That is your equity risk premium. So let's start off with some very basic propositions about this risk premium. First, it should be greater than zero. Let that rest for a while and think about why. Second, it should increase with how risk-averse you are as an individual. And third, it should depend on how risky you think equities are as an asset class. Let's take each of those. The greater than zero, let's set to the side. Let's talk about risk aversion. Is everybody in this room equally risk averse? No, right? Let's do some very broad categorizations, and if I'm insulting any of you, I'm sorry. Old people versus young people, who's more risk averse? People. Why? Because of families, responsibilities, etc. So let's draw the implication. If you have a market of aging investors, what should happen to equity risk premiums in that market? They should go up. You look at Japan, you look at Western Europe. This is a problem that both markets face. As investors age, risk premiums go up. Here's a touchier issue. Men and women. Who's more risk averse? The studies actually are very interesting. Young women are more risk averse than young men, which I can attest to 100%. Because with four kids, there's only one kid whose car I will get in. They can all drive, which is kind of a scary thought. But there's only one kid whose car I will get into, and that's my daughter. My sons, I will not. They're crazy. Getting into a car with a 25-year-old male is equivalent to committing collective suicide. Okay? Young women are more risk averse than young men. But as you age, risk aversion starts to even out by the age of 40, with one singular exception. Men remain less risk averse on small bets than women. What am I talking about? How many of you bet on the Super Bowl? Come on, you can tell me. It's okay. I won't tell your parents. As long as you didn't bet your entire tuition money on this. Okay? How many of you bet on the Super Bowl? Notice that I see only four male hands go up. Because women assess the probabilities. Expected value, 28%. No, $5. No, I'm not betting. Women, $5, who cares? You know, so men tend to be a little more sloppy about small bets all the way through their lives. Women tend to be a little more calculating. And now we come to a singular problem. If you walk into a trading room in any investment bank and you look around, what's a trading room disproportionately? What group of people are disproportionately represented in every trading room anywhere in the world? Young men. What did we just say about young men in terms of risk taking? This is the worst possible group you can allow into a risk-taking game. And then we wonder why we have $7 billion losses and $4 billion losses 4 years ago. Actually, just half in jest, I made a suggestion. This was after the Jerome Kerviel Society General. There was like a $5 billion trading scandal. I said there's a very simple way you can stop these trading problems if you're a banker. Here's what you need to do. When you hire a 25-year-old male to be a trader, hire his mother to sit behind him. Mothers are natural risk breakers. She's looking at her, what are you doing now? Why are you buying that? That's too dangerous. Don't do it, right? I mean, let's face it. Most males would not survive to reach the age of 25 without mother saying, don't do that. Don't even think about doing that. What are you thinking about, right? You're saying that'll cost us money. Pay every mother $100,000. Think about it. One $6 billion trading loss is going to cover every mother you pay for the rest of eternity. And let's think about not just risk aversion. There's a third factor, which is some risk aversion you're born with you can never, ever change. My four kids, I can tell you which one's going to be invested in stocks or which one's going to be invested in bonds for the rest of his life. I gave it away with the hiss there. And which one's going to be the option trader? My oldest is 26, still walks down the stairs holding on to the banister. I might fall now. That's a fixed income guy if you ever saw one, right? My youngest, when he was two, took off from the top stair, expecting to be caught before he hit the bottom. He's an option trader. Something will happen, no? Somebody will bail me out. So some risk aversion you can't fight. It's already built into you. So let's do a little test. Let's see how risk averse you are as a group and how much risk aversion varies in this room. So here's the game. We have to make an assumption here. The assumption we have to make is you actually have savings. It's kind of a tough assumption. You're 19, 20, 21. You're spending all your money in college. But let's assume you have savings. You moved up the ranks. You have a half a million, a million, whatever number makes you feel good. But you have it all invested in something risk-free making 3%. You're sitting down for dinner. And you get a call. And it's from me. I've quit my job. And I've become a salesperson for the Vanguard 500 index fund. And I offer you a deal you should not miss. I say, I've heard that you have all your money invested in something risk-free making 3%. You say, how do you know? I say, I have my sources. I have to keep you on the phone. You know, the conspiracy has to keep going. And then I offer you this chance of moving everything from where it is right now at 3% into the Vanguard 500, the S&P 500, the 500 largest market cap stocks. You ready? I'm going to offer you the total return on the S&P 500 on an expected basis. And if it's enough for you to do the switch, just put up your hand. So right now I'm making 3% guaranteed. This is the expected return on the S&P 500. There is one very wrong answer. And I'll let you guess which one that is, and I hope nobody picks it. And the other five are all potentially right answers. So how many of you would settle for less than 3%? That, of course, a lot of you would put up your hands. I said, you know what? You're beyond redemption. What's the point of the rest of the class? Let's cancel it all and go home. So thank God nobody picked it. Now we get into the potential choices that are depending on your risk aversion, would work. How many would settle for 3 to 5%? Okay, keep your hand up. As I said, no wrong answers. 1, 2, 3. Anybody else? Are these the most risk-averse people in the room or the least risk-averse people in the room? Least, you got a 50-50 shot. It's least risk-averse people in the room. Why? Because they were willing to switch into a risky asset without that much in premium. The premium you're demanding is between 0 and 2%. Okay, file them away, least risk-averse. 5 to 7. Okay, that's a premium of between 2 and 4. 7 to 9. Okay, we're looking like the middle of this. 9 to 11. More than 11%. Most risk averse don't walk behind these people on the stairs. They're going to hold on to banisters, double support on both sides. That's okay, right? Nothing good. But you can already see the reason if this were the entire market, you know what I should be using as an equity risk premium? A weighted average of all the numbers each of you came up with. Because each of you gave me a risk premium, 2, 4, 6. You're saying weighted by what? Not by how much enthusiasm you showed when you put up your hand, but by how much money you have. Let me be brutally honest with you. If you have no money, I don't care what your equity risk premium is. You can yell it at me, you can scream, it doesn't matter. This is not a democracy, it's a dollar-weighted democracy, which means if you have $1 billion, I'm really, really interested in what your risk premium is. If you have a dollar, go away. What Warren Buffett thinks about the equity risk premium right now matters more than what everybody in this building, this neighborhood, maybe this half of town, things right now. That's what $40 billion brings to the table. So if we're looking for an equity risk premium, that's all we need to do is, right, ask people what their premium is, take a weighted average. What are the practical problems of doing that? How many people invest in the stock market? I don't need a precise number. Lots. Millions. Can you imagine sending out an email? It'd be like one of those scam emails you get from Nigeria saying, I'm the widow of so-and-so. Please send me your bank account number. I will send you $15 million. The scary thing is somebody must send those people their bank account numbers. So you send out an email to 53 million people in the equity market saying, how much money do you have and what's your equity risk premium? Let's say you could pull it off and you get answers back. You know what the second problem is going to be? Is the number you gave me a number that will never change? Do you think the number you just gave me would have been different if I'd asked you 2 months ago, 6 months ago, 8 months ago? I think so. What's causing it to change? Well, let's assume tomorrow I told you that, or in fact, while you were sitting there, this hasn't happened, so don't freak out. Let's say while you were sitting here, in the last hour of the market dropped 25%. It hasn't happened, as I said, so don't freak out. But if it had actually happened, and I asked you the same question I asked you just a minute ago, each of you gave me a risk premium just a minute ago, do you think that premium would have gone up, gone down, or remained unchanged? How many would now demand a larger risk premium if the market, and why? What is it about the market going down that makes your risk premium go up? You get a reminder about risk, right? This is why in bull markets, it's so difficult to talk to people about risk. Because they get it intellectually. But if the market's been going up and up and up and up for 10 years, getting it intellectually is not the same thing as getting it in your gut. I mean, all you need is 2 months like the last 2 months, and you say, okay, that's what risk is. Which makes this problem even tougher, right? Because not only do I have to ask 53 million people what their risk premium is, I have to keep asking them the question, because the number's going to keep changing. So the challenge we face in trying to estimate equity risk premiums is we can't ask all these people. We can't keep asking them the question, how do we come up with an equity risk premium to use in corporate finance and valuation? So before I go on, any questions about the notion of an equity risk premium? So it's going to vary across people. It's going to vary across time. It's going to vary across markets. Let's set that on the table. So whatever approach we come up with has to meet all those dynamic requirements. Yes?
If the stock market goes down, doesn't that mean that there's more upside risk versus downside risk?
Okay. In fact, I forgot to ask a question. I said, how many of you would demand a larger premium? I should have also asked, how many of you demand a smaller premium? Because there is, have you heard of what contrarian investing is? What do contrarian investors do? They buy after the price has gone down. The argument being, if the S&P was a good buy at 1700, it must be an even better buy at 1200, right? And so you could actually argue that for some people, your risk premium could actually come down, which is, again, a changing risk premium. So either way the risk premium is changing, I'll also tell you that being a contrarian intellectually is easy to do. Being a contrarian in practice is the most difficult thing to do. Test it out. Tomorrow, as the market is down 600 points, and there will be a day when it's down 600 points, try to buy something. You want your hand to go to the keyboard, but your hand will be frozen. Go, go. And you say, buy, no, I'll wait. Right? And it's human nature. It's because we've got that gene inside each of us, which is the panic gene. Which is, if you see a crowd running towards you, and it's all people running in a complete panic, what's the most logical thing for you to do? You don't even know what they're running from, is to turn and run with them. Because you know what happens to contrarians? I mean, imagine being a cave contrarian. One of those cave people is a contrarian. Your entire tribe keeps running towards you. You keep running in the opposite direction. Sooner or later, you're going to get stomped by a mammoth. So it's human nature to fight this. But at the same time, some people can overcome it and say, I'm okay. I can buy stocks now that they're cheaper. So here are the three ways in which I'm going to take you through estimating this risk premium. The first is I'm going to do something that I said could not be done. Ask people what their risk premium is. It's a survey approach. But I'm going to show you how it's been tried by a few entities, where they try to ask people, what's your equity risk premium? Obviously, they can't ask everybody. They ask a subset. And you'll see the different subsets they focused on. The second, what's the question you're trying to answer? What will I make on stocks as opposed to something risk-free, right? So you know what the second approach is? You look backwards. So what would I have made on stocks over the last 50 years, the last 70 years, the last 80 years, relative to something risk-free? That's called a historical premium. That's how 90% of investment banks, consulting firms, and corporations get their risk premiums, going backwards.
Yeah. Why is that the risk premium?
Well, that's what you earn. So you're saying that that's what I would have earned in the past. What's the assumption you're making? The future. I agree with you. But think of how many things we do in life where we base things on, it's called mean reversion. We assume that things revert back to the way they used to be. Could it be dangerous? Absolutely.
I don't mean like in terms of forecasting. Why is the fact the market did earn that percentage means that that's what people needed to be in the market?
No, then it's not that they need it. They're saying if I'm looking towards the future, what I earned in the past is the best predictor of what I will earn in the future. That's what they're assuming when they use a historical. I agree, but you're sitting there wanting a number. It's not about you, right? It's about everybody in the market. If it were just your gut, you can say, I want to make 7%, you can put in 7%, but it's about figuring out everybody else's gut, and because that's so messy, you say, I look at the past and assume that's what people on average require. It's an assumption. It could be wrong. There's a third approach I'm going to offer you, which I think is the most flexible way of thinking about risk premiums. It's dynamic and forward-looking. Because the problem with these other two approaches, they're backward-looking, and they're asking all the wrong people. So I'm going to call it an implied premium, and I'm going to give that to you as your third choice. And I'm going to push it as strongly as I can as the preferred alternative if you're doing corporate finance and valuation. So let's start with the first one. You can ask people, but you can't ask all of them. So you have to pick subsets. So over the last 35 or 40 years, there are all these services that have tried this. The first is this association called the Securities Industries Association. It's one of those trade groups. And what they used to do was they used to ask individual investors, just like I did you, what do you think stocks will do over the next year? And they would report that premium. And they stopped in 2004 because they discovered it was one of the most useless exercises ever. Because what people were doing was extrapolating the past. So if you ask them after 5 good years, what do you think stocks will do? They said stocks will be up 20%. You ask them after 3 bad years. So they said, why are we even wasting our time asking these people? They just reflect the past. The second set of surveys continues. Merrill Lynch, every month, asks institutional investors around the world the same question. What do you think stocks will do over the next year? And they report it as a monthly premium. That number in 2013 was 4.8%. The 2015 update that I saw, it's about 5%. So it's increased a little bit. But that's across institutional investors, and the argument there is they control the most money, so what they think should be weighted more. There are two professors at Duke, Campbell Harvey and John Graham, who survey CFOs. Very different group, right? Because they're not investors, but they use risk premiums within companies to come up with hurdle rates. And across CFOs in 2012, the number was about 4.5%. That number now is about 4.75%. So CFOs are saying the premium is 4.75. Pablo Fernandez, who teaches in Spain, does these gigantic surveys of 8,000 people in 101 countries. He likes big numbers. So he used to do, he's done a survey of equity research analysts. So what do you use as an equity risk premium? That number in 2011 was 5%. That's pretty much stayed around 5% since then. And then perhaps the most useless survey of all, Pablo surveys academics. You see why that's useless? What did I say I weight your premium by? How much money you have. So what do I care what a finance professor thinks about the equity risk premium? But I guess we have a disproportionately large effect because other people end up using these premiums. And that survey gave about 5.7%. Having said all of this, I cannot think of a single investment bank, consulting firm, or corporation that uses a survey premium. Even Merrill internally doesn't use these premiums because, again, they reflect the past more than the future. They can be volatile depending on what happened during the course of a day. I ask you at 9 o'clock, you give me one answer. 5 o'clock, you get a very different answer. So they're nice for show, but I don't think anybody uses survey premiums. The only area where I've seen survey premiums used was in real estate. And even there, it's changing. In real estate, what used to happen is Cushman and Wakefield, which is his outfit in New York, would survey real estate developers around the country and say, what are you demanding as a rate of return for investing in a commercial property in Florida? And they would break down by state and by type of property what investors in real estate were demanding. It's the only business where I've seen people use surveys. Which brings me to historical premiums. So here's what they're trying to do in a historical premium. You look backwards. So you already can know, confessing that you don't know what the future will bring. You look backwards, you pick a time period, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years. Then you compute on average what you'd have made investing in stocks over this period. And then you compute on average what you'd have made investing in T-bonds or T-bills over this period. Then you look at the difference. So it's not rocket science. It's called a historical risk premium. And when you do this, be very clear about what you're assuming. You're assuming that there's mean reversion, that things always revert back to the way they used to be, that risk aversion is not changing over time in a market, and that the riskiness of the market is also not changing. I'll make a confession. Prior to 2008, in my corporate finance class, I used to allow people to use a historical risk premium. Post-2008, I pushed back as hard as I can against this use. You see what happened in 2008? What happened in 2008? We got a lesson. We got a lesson that the past is not always an extension of the future. That the old world order is broken up. You can't assume that we're going to go back to 1985 or 95 because the U.S. is no longer the center of the global economic universe. To me, it's called a structural shift. When you have a structural shift, the most dangerous thing you can do is go back and look at history. But historical risk premiums have their allure because they're there. You can look them up. Duff and Phelps publishes them now. Ibbotson used to publish them. There are these services that we, so you can look at them and say, hey, the premium right now is 5.71%. Well, Duff and Phelps, you actually have to pay, I think, a few hundred dollars to get the equity risk premium. I'll save you the money. Start of every year. Now, at the start of every year, I actually compute the historical risk premiums for the U.S. Notice the word I use, premiums. You're saying, why premiums? Because it depends on what time period I look at. I looked at three different time periods. I got different premiums. I looked at T-bills versus T-bonds. I got different premiums. Remember, both can be used as risk-free. And I also got different premiums depending on whether I computed an arithmetic average or a geometric average. You never thought you'd ever revisit statistics again, right? What's the difference between what's an arithmetic average first? Let's start with the easy one. What do I do with an arithmetic average? I add up 85 numbers and divide by 85, right? What do I do in a geometric average? I look at a compounded return. I'll give you a very simple example of how the two can deviate. Let's suppose you invest $100 in a stock. It doubles next year. So what is the return in the first year? 100%. Then it halves the year after. So it goes 100, 200, back to 100. Let me ask you a question. You started at 100, you ended at 100. How much money do you make on this stock? Don't take too long to think about the answer. The answer is, I didn't make any money. But through the magic of arithmetic averaging, I'm going to convince you that you made a 25% return. Because here's what happened. In the first year, what did you have? 100% return. You went from 100 to 200. Second year, we went from 200 to 100. That's a minus 50% return. 100 minus 50 is 50. You divide by 2. You thought you made nothing, really. You made a 25% return. Of course, it's a complete lie. The geometric average return is 0. The arithmetic average is 25%. So that's why I have 12 different numbers as my risk premiums. So I'm going to close with three very simple suggestions about the historical risk premium. The first is, if you're going to use a historical risk premium, which I think is a mistake in the first place, make sure you go back as far as you can. That sounds absurd. What year do I want you to go back to? 1928. That was 3 years before the Great Depression. You think the U.S. equity market was a very different market then? Of course it was. So why do I want you to go back to 1928? Take a look at those standard errors. If you remember your statistics, every time you make an estimate, you have to tell me how much error there is in the estimate. With 87 years of data, that standard error is 2.29%. With 10 years of data, what's the standard error? Might as well have told me nothing. The standard error was 8.66%. I need a lot of data to even make a statement about the risk premium. Go back as far as you can. Second, what did I say I was going to use as my risk-free rate? T-bills or T-bonds in corporate finance? I said I was going to stick with T-bonds. I don't care about the T-bill premium. And third, I'm going to use the geometric average because this number is going to compound over time, which means if I'm using a historical premium, the number I'd be using would be 4.54% today. That's a 2016 historical premium. And I'd be using it for the rest of the year because it's not going to change over the course of the year. So when we start on Monday, this is what we're going to start with. We're going to start with the historical premium. We're going to talk about how to come up with risk premiums for countries where you don't have history. And then we'll talk about the implied premium. Yes?
Thank you.
Guys, there's no class on Monday. I forgot to mention that. It's whatever day. President's Day. So do whatever you do on President's Day. I don't know what that is.
Hi. So you want to estimate the hurdle rate for a small company that, say, just started, no debt or whatever, right? It's all equity. Would you add a premium just because of the fact that it's, like, barely starting?
Let's get to that when we get to that. We haven't even talked about risk premiums and beta, so... Once we do all of that, then we'll ask them. But first, what are you most scared about with the young startup? What's the risk you're worried about?
Well, I mean, like, you don't know how risky.
That's not the risk. The risk is that the company will not make it.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
That's not risk designed for a discount. It's risk designed for something else. The expected cash flows. So it's a very different risk. You don't want to force those kinds of risks into discount rates because discount rates are for going concern risks. Your biggest fear here is it's not going to be a growing concern. So here's a very simple way. Let's say there's a 70% chance you will not make it. What's your business going to be worth then? Nothing. There's a 30% chance it'll make it. Use a traditional discount rate. But once you adjust for the fact that 70% of the time you get nothing, your value will reflect it. Okay? There are other mechanisms for dealing with that risk. Don't let the discount rate be the mechanism for bringing it in. Okay?
Thanks. That's right. I have two questions.
Yeah.
Thank you.